Well, yeah, there's just an enormous amount of activity, really, in a very, very short period of time. I suppose one of the key things was it was the kind of coming of age, the sudden coming of age of the long playing record as the kind of main vessel of popular music of all kinds. And that this market was suddenly growing almost week on week. And so you had in the summer of the year, you had Carole King's Tapestry, which had come out in February, March, is selling 150,000 copies a week in the United States alone, which is just absolutely staggering. What was happening was that you had this generation of people who were suddenly fixing on this long-playing record as the thing that they wanted. And it's quite interesting to me that it was a luxury, but it was an affordable luxury. You couldn't have one every week unless you were pretty wealthy, but you might have one every few weeks. And so these records, they fulfilled the function not only just of something to listen to, but also something to think about. And they had some of the qualities of paperback novels, or some of the qualities of kind of the gossip magazines and so forth. You kept track of Carole King, of James Taylor, of Carly Simon, all these kind of people. And you got some insight via their records into what was happening in their lives. And so what I remember most clearly about it at that time is that records were the only thing I wanted. All my consumer desires were entirely focused on long playing records and the acquisition of more of them. I didn't want anything else. You couldn't really have anything else. And so that was a kind of unrepeatable moment in the history of popular culture, it seems to me.
Tapestry was a remarkable album and a real game changer, not only for the artist, but as you write, in terms of tapping into a new audience of young women who had not been big record buyers before that.
Well, not buyers of long playing records. And it's interesting, a bunch of things are happening at the same time. That I quote an interview which took place later in the year with the guy who was the kind of senior person at the American Music Business Federation. And they say to him, "Do you think it's possible that people other than teenagers might buy records?" And he said, "Do you know, I think they might." You know, it had obviously never occurred to anybody before that people might carry their interests beyond their teenage years into young adulthood and ultimately into adulthood and ultimately into kind of senior citizenship, you know. That was not seen coming at the time. And so Tapestry was, I think, you know, sold disproportionately to young women because they felt it reflected their lives. And also it was just a terrifically good record. And as one of her fellow songwriters is quoted as saying, that Carole King has the voice that every woman likes to think she has. And I think that's a very good point, that it's not a voice full of, you know, pyrotechnics. It's not Aretha Franklin. It's just a kind of, it's quite a modest voice that you can imagine having yourself, you know, singing to yourself while doing the chores or whatever. That's the voice that you hear in your head is Carole King's voice. And it's a very affecting record, and it still is a very affecting record. And it's amazing to think, I mean, you know, she's coming to London in summer this year to perform it in its entirety for the first time ever on stage. And it's still the basis of, you know, her musical Beautiful, which is running in London and Broadway and all over the world. You know, those things endure to an extraordinary extent. And I think there's something about the modesty of that record that gives it its appeal. It sort of doesn't quite sound finished. You know, it sounds a bit like a demo, which is one of the very appealing things about it, that you can kind of fill in the blanks yourself.
One of the real seminal moments of that year was when Stevie Wonder met Tonto, as it's called, the synthesizer, that all of a sudden shifted the power away from producers and certainly, in this case, away from a Berry Gordy into the hands of the artist.
Well, very much in his case, he couldn't believe it because he was 21 in 1971, which meant that he was suddenly free of Motown, that he could go to another record company. As it happened, he re-signed with Motown on very advantageous terms. But, you know, he suddenly had a freedom he hadn't had before, and he moved to New York, and via a musician friend of his, he was introduced to Malcolm Cecil and Robert Margalef, who were the guys who'd been developing this polyphonic synthesizer. at Media Sound Studios in New York. And so he goes down there to have it demonstrated for him. And Stevie Wonder simply can't believe that he can kind of press these keys and all kinds of sounds, all the sounds in the universe seemingly are suddenly at his command. You know, these are sounds that previously he'd always needed loads of different session men and different specialists to actually produce. And so that was the beginning of the kind of great purple patch that led into, you know, Talking Book and Music of My Mind and Fulfilling This First Finale, the great hot streak of Stevie Wonder kind of starts in 1971.
And when you look at the songs, look at the artists who really came to prominence that year, like Bowie, Pink Floyd, Elton John, Led Zeppelin, and on the list goes. What was it about that time in the culture of not only the United States, but of Great Britain as well, that made all this a burst of creativity possible?
Well, I think they had opportunities because they were backed. You know, the record companies were happy to pay for these records to be made because they were selling, you know, because the business was growing, the appetite was there. And also they hadn't quite got to the point of being self-indulgent. Most of these records were made very, very quickly. In a way that, you know, nothing is done that quickly nowadays. So David Bowie, for instance, in 1971, puts out Man Who Sold the World, records and puts out Hunky Dory, and records all but one track of Ziggy Stardust from the Spiders from Mars in the calendar year 1971. And he wasn't even a big star at that point. You know, I think what is quite significant with a lot of these guys is they were in their late 20s, which is just the perfect time to realize your potential. They didn't have anything to lose, and they weren't trying to protect anything. They were just moving relentlessly forward. Some would say as if they believed it was going to go on forever. Well, of course, we learned that it didn't go on forever, and that, oddly enough, they had to spend the rest of their career trying to get back what they did instinctively in 1971. And so often, and some of these acts, you know, some of these people have passed away, but some of these acts are still playing live, you know, one form or another, you know, the Rolling Stones and the Who and Rod Stewart and Carole King. And the songs that people want to hear from them, the songs that they cannot leave the stage without doing, are the songs from 1971. The Who could not leave the stage without playing Won't Get Fooled Again and Barbara O'Reilly. The Rolling Stones could not leave the stage without playing Brown Sugar. It's simply compulsory. You know, Elton John cannot leave the stage without doing Your Song. And there is something about the music of this year which was just them at their very best. A lot of them did good stuff afterwards. I don't think any of them really did anything better. I think you could argue Joni Mitchell, possibly. Court and Spark is a wonderful record which comes out a few years later. But most of these people, it was the high point, because inspiration is quite a fleeting thing. Careers are a long thing, but inspiration comes in quite short bursts, is what we've discovered when we look back. And when you look back at what they did this extraordinary stuff, you know, in a very condensed period of time.
We're talking with David Hepworth, the author of Never a Dull Moment, 1971, the year that rock exploded. And as you point out late in the book, this was not just a great year for the big hit makers, but for people who often wouldn't come to be appreciated for many, many years, like Nick Drake, a great album by Gene Clark that year, Bonnie Raitt, John Prine, Loudon Wainwright, and so many others.
Yes, there was too much going on for these people to get the attention that they possibly deserved. You know, there was no time for records that were a bit of a slow burn. And Nick Drake was the classic case of this, you know, that he puts out Brighter Later in 1971. And later in the year, he goes and records Pink Moon over 2 days, then leaves the tapes in Island Records reception, and is pretty much never heard of again. But those records were very, you know, they were very slow to reveal their appeal. And so you had things that were slightly more immediate, like Rod Stewart, Maggie May, and The Who, and The Rolling Stones, and David Bowie, and Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, and all this stuff. And so very often that stuff had to wait quite a long time. And I think it might be Robin Hitchcock who said that, you know, Big Star was a letter posted in 1971 that didn't arrive until 1989 or something. And, you know, it's quite interesting. A lot of this stuff got picked up way later. And also, what intrigued me going back and looking at it was that loads of the kind of acts who were seen as the kind of founding fathers of, you know, the punk rock revolution of 1976-77, they had pretty much stopped by 1971. You know, so David Bowie goes to New York, you know, he's completely unknown, and he goes to see the Velvet Underground in February. And backstage, he buttonholes who he thinks is Lou Reed, the singer. And of course, he's not talking to Lou Reed at all, because Lou Reed's left the band. Mm-hmm. He's talking to Doug Yule. You know, Lou Reed had gone home to his dad, thinking, you know, there's never going to be any future in this music lark. And so it's only later in the year, via the kind of patronage of people like David Bowie, that he comes back and, you know, and restarts as a solo artist. And so the Stooges had kind of given up. But you got the people like the Modern Lovers are making their first demos of, you know, Roadrunner and Hospital and all these songs. They're actually doing them in 1971 at the same time as Gene Clark's making White Light. You know, all this stuff was going on at the same time.
In a year that began with Pink Floyd going into the Abbey Road studios to record, that ended with Don McLean flying up the charts worldwide with American Pie, you look at Elvis Presley and what happened to him at the end of the year, his meeting with President Richard Nixon and his association with Vegas taking hold. What did that end of the year event, series of events, say about the future of pop music?
Well, I thought it was interesting that there's a big piece in Rolling Stone at the end of the year by John Landau, who at the time was the kind of senior rock critic, and he was only about 24, which is amazing to think. And he goes to see Elvis Presley, who's playing at a stadium in Boston, and he sees this very kind of choreographed event, you know, this show with lots of Mackie musicians and you know, and singers and set pieces and bits of drama and bits of often scripted hokum, and he writes this very you know, favorable review of you know, he says we should respect Elvis Presley, you know, his best work may be behind him, but people come along to be reminded of their youth. And the thing that struck me about it reading that review is that's what happened to all pop music subsequently. Elvis was, oddly enough, leading the way for what we go and see nowadays when we go and see the big arena show. You pay a lot of money and you pay largely to be reminded of something that took place 5 years, 10 years, 20 years earlier. It happened before. Prior to that, people went to see acts playing their new stuff, largely. They didn't do their greatest hits. But that started to change with people like Elvis Presley, because everybody was starting to got aware after 1971 that, hey, this could go on for a while. You know, these were still the days, don't forget, when Mick Jagger said, I can't imagine doing this when I'm 40, right. Which is hilarious. Now, how old is Mick Jagger? I don't know, 75 or something. And, you know, and they're still going on, all these people. Nobody foresaw that whatsoever. But as soon as you have a long career like that, the only thing you can do is kind of pace yourself and you know, work on the basis you've learned what it is that people want to come and see when they come and see you. At the time, they hadn't really, but Elvis had.
One of the things you mentioned is that music was really the common language of young people in this country because they were not tuning into TV, they weren't going to the movies. With so many options out there in the world for people and their entertainment today, can we ever see a time like 1971 again?
Now, I've got a simple answer to this, no. It will never happen again. That's not to say that there isn't great musical talent around. I'm sure there is. But never again will music have the unimpeded, uninterrupted focus of huge numbers of young people in the way that it had in 1971. Because there was nothing else. You know, I used to spend all my time in record shops, just hanging around record shops. I couldn't afford to buy anything most of the time. I just wanted to be near records. It's all I wanted to do. And I was not alone in that. Nowadays, you know, my own children, whatever, they simply wouldn't get that excited about one particular music carrier, you know, because music is just something that they can flick a switch and it comes to them. It's absolutely available all the time. It used to be something you had to seek out. Now it's something you got to avoid. You know, these things are, you know, they pursue you absolutely all the time. And so we live in a state of constant distraction nowadays. And that, you know, that's the price we pay for a kind of wealthy consumer society with loads and loads of entertainment options. It wasn't quite like that in 1971.
What's your favorite song from that year?
Well, I always say that the apogee of 1971 rock and roll. So if you like, the best bit of the best track of the best album of the best year is 1:06 into Barbara O'Reilly by The Who, which you're probably familiar with. It's the bit where the, you know, after they've had the electronic intro with the synthesizer and the Keith Moon's drums have arrived. And what happens is Roger Daltrey's vocal and John Entwistle's bass guitar arrive simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And it's like being somebody's grabbed hold of you by the scruff of your neck and lifted you up in the air. And it still sounds wonderful 45 years later. So that is the answer, Rich. Well, it's as simple as that. I've actually pointed it out for you. That's the answer.
There we go. We'll go back to it, because one of the wonderful things about your book that I've now read twice, I enjoyed it so much, is that it also made me go back and listen to those songs and listen to many of them on the original vinyl, which is the only way to truly appreciate them, I think.
It makes a lot of difference. It certainly does. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.